our discussion of this topic this week. We're not being terribly rigorous about the things that we're talking about. We're really just hitting a lot of things in a light and hopefully somewhat memorable way. We'll see about that as time goes by, whether it's memorable or not. But this morning we are going to be thinking about the creation account, and not so much by going over that bit by bit, as just looking at and thinking about some perspectives on that. I would assume that most of us who are here today believe in the creation account in Genesis. There may be some qualms about some aspects of that account in some of our minds. Some of us may have a hang-up about the 6 days, whether they're literal days or not. I believe that they are 6 literal days, that just as described and as treated throughout Scripture. Some of us may have hang-ups about other aspects of the timing that's presented to us in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. But again, I believe that those are brought to us in a pretty straightforward way, and that the earth is several thousand years old as presented to us in the book of Genesis. I don't find anywhere to shovel in a million years here, a million years there, or any time frame that's actually going to do any good in reconciling the Genesis account with the presentations of modern science in this area. Efforts to do that have ended up with an empty account in Genesis, and that's all you really can end up with when you try and dovetail that account with the perception that has been presented for a long time now, not only in the public media, but in public education in this country and really in much of the Western world. After some 70 years of indoctrination, though, it still seems to be true today, according to the polling done by George Barna, it still seems to be true that after some 70 years of institutional indoctrination in the educational system, that some 70% of American people still believe that the Genesis account of the creation is true. Now, that doesn't mean, I don't think, that they all believe that it's 6 days of creation, nor does it mean that they don't believe that evolution is a part of that picture. And I believe it is a part of the picture in terms of adaptation, as we talked about a little bit in the context of coming off the ark yesterday, microevolution, adapting to the environment in which animals find themselves by the providence of God, as His Spirit still works in the created world. But a majority of people in this country still profess to believe in the idea of special creation. And sometimes you'd have a hard time discerning that that's the case with what you see on TV, reading the newspapers, and here in the school system. If it weren't for the caption, I doubt that you would have any idea of what's going on there. This is Wild 2, or Wild 2. Wild 2. This is a comet. It's a picture, or a series of pictures, that was taken of the comet Wild 2 on a recent flyby with a NASA spacecraft back in January. The animation was made with images captured by NASA's Stardust spacecraft as it flew past comet Wild 2. The spacecraft captured samples of comet dust and snapped some of the clearest images of a comet nucleus ever taken. And that was a pretty exciting event. It was pretty exciting to get that kind of a close-up image of a comet and capture some portions, some particles of it. And then to turn that spacecraft around and head it toward home with the expectation of it making a soft landing and in a couple of years recovering those samples and being able to analyze what makes up a comet. But why are we out there in space in spending tens of millions of dollars, actually hundreds of millions of dollars, why are we out there in space spending hundreds of millions of dollars to capture pictures of comets and comet dust? What is the interest on that? Well, in June there was an article about the flyby in our local newspaper and in a lot of other newspapers as well, including probably your local newspaper somewhere in the same time frame. And the heading on the article certainly caught my eye. I mentioned previously that I really enjoy stories like this that say, hey, we didn't know what we were talking about. So that's what a comet looks like. Pictures show scientists had it all wrong. Well, it's not the first time. It won't be the last time. There are lots of areas where scientists, in fact, have it all wrong, where they have expectations of what they're going to find. And then when the actual research is done, or when they're able to actually experimentally test their hypotheses, it turns out that they were wrong. There are a lot of things that are commonly believed that have been built up over a period of years and hold a consensus opinion that simply are wrong. And when it comes to what they expected this comet to be and to look like, it turned out that they were wrong. An excerpt from the article: this could prove to be a pivotal time for science, a remarkable opportunity to gather evidence that might actually tell us how the planets formed and give us clues about how life on Earth began, said Brownlee, a University of Washington astronomer and principal investigator for the Stardust mission. What is the Stardust mission all about? Why are we out there trying to get pictures, close-up pictures of a comet, and gather samples of what a comet is made of? Well, because we're still trying, from a scientific viewpoint, we're still trying to figure out how the solar system was formed. We still don't know how the planets came to be here from that uniformitarian, materialistic, scientific perspective. It would be real easy if you paid attention to things that have been in print over the last 30 years in various science periodicals, various magazines, various publications, to think that astronomers have got this all figured out, physicists have this all figured out. We have a mechanistic explanation for the origin of the universe in general and our solar system in particular. But in fact, there is not a viable mechanistic explanation for the origin of the planets. There is not a viable mechanistic explanation for the origin of the moon. And even more importantly, as indicated in Brownlee's comment here, there is no viable, non-personal explanation for the origin of life. You can read explanations for the origin of life in standard biology textbooks at every level at which biology is taught. But the fact is, there is no standard recognized explanation for the origin of life in biology today. There's no suitable explanation. Every explanation has got gaping holes that you could drive a truck through, that kind of hole. Every explanation has got gaping holes in it that leave it in a completely unsatisfactory position. We tried, you know, the idea that it was life originated in seawater. The chemicals came together, but seawater disperses those kinds of chemicals. They get mixed in with the water. It's impossible to bring together the vital components for life in seawater. We've tried having it in various kinds of pond scum and bubbles on the ocean and down in deep sea vents where there's heat, and because you need a lot of energy. Life takes a lot of energy, and none of those explanations have proven satisfactory at all. And so where are we today as far as science is concerned for an explanation of life? Well, Francis Crick sounded like a crank when he came out with this idea some 25 years ago that life came from outer space. He sounded like and if you don't know who Francis Crick is, he's one of the discoverers of the DNA molecule, the nature of the DNA molecule, the spiral configuration there. That's not the right word, the double helix configuration of the DNA module. A scientist who won the Nobel Prize in the 1950s, but in the 1970s, he was talking about life being seeded from outer space, and he was being laughed at for that perspective. But where has science come to in the early 21st century as far as the origin of life? Well, it must have been seeded from outer space, because there is no reasonable explanation for the mechanistic origin of life on Earth at this time. And so where do we look? Well, we look at comets. Maybe comets had something to do with bringing life to Earth, or bringing the vital components for life to Earth. Maybe somehow there is an outer space explanation. You remember all the excitement a couple of years ago with the rock, the meteor that's supposed to have come from Mars and had the little nodules on it, and they were saying maybe these are microscopic fossils of microbes that used to live on Mars. Maybe there were microbes on Mars and this thing was shot to Earth, and maybe that's an explanation of how life got to be here on Earth. Well, it's a nonsense explanation, and those turned out, of course, not to be fossilized life at all, just little bits of rock. And there are all kinds of problems with that perspective, but those who have a mechanistic view of the world, of the universe, of the cosmos, of man himself, are desperately seeking a solution to the question, where did life come from, and how did the planets come into being? How did all this form? How did this apparent order come out of disorder? And there is no satisfactory explanation for this. So the question of how the planets formed is still a wide open question in terms of what science can discover independent of the revelation of God. And we're still searching for clues about how life began on Earth. How life began on Earth. We don't know these things from a purely intellectual scientific perspective. We have no answers for these kinds of questions as yet, in spite of the fact that it often seems as though science is putting forth, or scientists are putting forth, the perspective that they really have things figured out. Now, this comment is from the JPL NASA site, JPL Jet Propulsion Laboratory, NASA JPL. You know, when it comes to running aircraft experiments, JPL has done some very good things. When it comes to philosophy, you really need to be wary of JPL, because they are driven by a mechanistic worldview, an atheistic worldview, a worldview that is very antagonistic to the idea of creation. And you'll find again and again news releases coming from NASA JPL, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, that evoke a philosophy that is contrary to a biblical worldview, and not merely contrary, but hostilely commentary. Nevertheless, a quotation from the NASA site regarding the Veald 2 comet. "We thought Comet Wild 2 would be like a dirty, black, fluffy snowball," said Stardust Principal Investigator Dr. Donald Brownlee of the University of Washington, Seattle. "Instead, it was mind-boggling to see the diverse landscape in the first pictures from Stardust, including spires, pits, and craters, which must be supported by a cohesive surface." It just was not the kind of object that they expected it to be. The Stardust team theorizes sublimation and object hits may have created the comet's distinct features. "Some features may have formed billions of years ago when life began on Earth," Brownlee said. Okay? "Some features may have formed billions of years ago when life began on Earth." I wanted to again emphasize the perspective that is being brought to bear in much of what is going on in our space research program today. "Particles collected by Stardust 2 during the Veald 2 encounter may help unscramble the secrets of how the solar system was formed." Well, I'm not so sure that it's a secret per se, how the solar system was formed. We had a reading that included the account of the fourth day of creation a little while ago, and we're not going to go over that in detail. But we have a picture of how the solar system was formed that is simply not acceptable to the mind of modern man, let alone postmodern man, that God could reveal the basic outline, not in any great detail. We certainly don't know exhaustively from the account that we have in Genesis, but we do know truly from the account that we have in Genesis how the solar system was formed by the command of God, by the word of God. These things existed, and there is no good alternative explanation for that. "Comets have been objects of fascination throughout the ages." Again, this is from the JPL website. "Many scientists believe they delivered carbon and water, life's building blocks, to Earth." How did life come to Earth? How did the basic elements that produce life and sustain life come to Earth? Many scientists believe that it was comets who brought them to Earth. Unfortunately, this comet doesn't seem to fit that mold. It doesn't seem to be the right kind of material and the right kind of structure for that. "Yet their destructive potential is illustrated by the widely held theory that a comet or asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs." I found that statement kind of fascinating. How is a destructive potential illustrated by a theory? That's kind of going around in a circle. Do you realize that a theory doesn't illustrate a potential? A theory illustrates an idea or an interpretation. Now, we do have something that could illustrate indeed the destructive potential of comets, and that was a couple of years ago when the, I knew the name of that comet this morning, the Something Levy comet. Anyone going to help me with that crashed into Jupiter, and the astronomers were watching that with great interest and perplexity? Something Levy, and I can't think of the first part of that name. Shoemaker-Levy, thank you, that's right. When the Shoemaker-Levy comet crashed into Jupiter, and the astronomers were all looking, and all of the best instrumentation we had was looking at the event that took place there, with a desire to see indeed what the destructive potential of a comet crashing into a planet would be. And it was indeed quite impressive. There certainly is a destructive potential in having comets crash into planets, and that is very much tied into the current idea of uniformitarianism, that everything goes along as it has since the beginning of creation, except for from time to time you have these impact incidents that cause mass extinctions and tremendous destruction in this world as a possibility, as one of the kinds of ideas that's being held. But as stated here, this is a circular kind of reasoning. The destructive potential of comets is illustrated by the widely held theory that a comet or asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs. And we should appreciate that very often scientific reasoning is presented to us, at least in the public, and really even in the laboratory and in education, in a very circular way, that the premise supports the conclusion because the conclusion indicates that the premise is true. We have a couple of little robots, little radio-controlled cars running around on the planet Mars right now. Did you know there were blueberries on Mars? Well, you understand that this isn't about blueberries. This is about little nodules. Mars blueberries give strong support to water theory. Why are we so interested in there being water on Mars? Is it because we think that in the real near future we're going to be able to send people there and, you know, set something up and the people are going to need water? Why is there tremendous interest in there being water on Mars? And why was it a big news story 4 or 5 years ago that they had concluded there was some water, some ice on the moon in a shadowed area where the sunlight doesn't fall? And And when we look at Europa, when we're looking at the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and we see that there are signs of maybe volcanic activity and maybe ice on some of these planetary bodies out there in the solar system, what is the huge big deal about water? From the standpoint of Genesis, you know, there's water above and there's water below, and I don't have a problem at all from a creation standpoint of there being water out there. And when I look at the windows of heaven being open, there may have been some water from out there coming in a catastrophic way, for all I know, and maybe some of it's bled off in the meantime through the atmosphere. Maybe some of that's been lost in the meantime. I don't know. Those are possibilities. But what's the great interest in finding water out there, in saying that Mars used to have water on it or may have subterranean water on it now? Well, it's because we understand that one of the basic necessities for life, certainly, is water. You're not going to have life if you don't have water. And there is this urgent desire to find life out there, to give support to the idea that life is just an easy thing, that wherever you have the basic components of water and heat, you're likely to have life. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Life is not simple. We know that it's not simple. We know that life doesn't just happen into being in any and every circumstance, that in fact, it's a tremendously difficult proposition to explain life on Earth, let alone in other places. But we are desperately looking for life. We, as a scientific culture, are desperately looking for life in other places in order to prop up a theory of origins that has very inadequate support in the place in which we are living, on the planet on which we live. So they're looking for water on Mars because they're trying to support the idea, and we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on these projects because they're trying to support the idea of how life formed mechanistically in a uniformitarian system with no intelligent purpose or design. This is from an article that was in the American Spectator in May. Our recent success on Mars leaves us no reason to think otherwise that we are alone. Are we alone is the question. Our recent success on Mars leaves us no reason to think otherwise and reason to ponder what makes the Earth unique. And there is a lot that makes the Earth unique. This article touched on some of those things, and so I'm going to share some of those things with you. And they are reasons to believe that Genesis is true, that what is described there is the only viable explanation for the world in which we live, which is uniquely designed for life. The American taxpayers recently footed the bill for a risky $800 million NASA mission. The good news? It worked. Well, we had several before that in a row that didn't work, but this one did work. In January, two NASA landers bounced to their destinations and released their rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, to prowl the Martian landscape. These remarkable little robots were not searching for archaeological ruins or strange black monoliths, but something much less exotic, the fingerprints of water in liquid form. And the first evidence is in. Mars, as long suspected, probably once had some liquid water on its surface. But why all the fuss and expense in search of this humble substance? Quite simply, it's because most astrobiologists now realize that such water is necessary not just for earthly life, but for life anywhere. But unbridled enthusiasm for ETs has obscured the obvious. Liquid water is a necessary condition for life, but not nearly a sufficient one. Life doesn't just spring up spontaneously out of water. It's not as if life has only one instruction in its recipe, just add water. In fact, what is striking is not that Mars once had lots of liquid water on its surface, but that although it was probably bathed by earthly microbes during the same time, see, if Mars rocks can get to us, then Earth rocks can get there too. You know, the possibility has to go both ways. And microbes can go through the troposphere, go out through the atmosphere into outer space. So even though it's very likely that earthly microbes will have reached other places in the solar system, there's no evidence that life prospered on the red planet. That's the most important but almost overlooked lesson of our study of Mars, is that it just doesn't look like there is life there or really has been life there, in spite of opportunities, if the general consensus in science is true, despite opportunities for it to be there. Yet the expectation that life is everywhere lives on. Why this pervasive opinion among scientists, the media, and the public at large? And this is true also. Even though 70% of the population believes that the Genesis account is true, a lot of those same people believe that there are scads of alien civilizations out there, and that maybe ETs have visited planet Earth, and so on, and so on, and so on. And it's not just because of science fiction, it's also because of the other kind of science fiction. That is, science falsely stated. Among scientists, at least, it comes not so much from scientific discovery as from an assumption called the Copernican principle, or principle of mediocrity. Martian life enthusiast Percival Lowell summed up the basic idea in 1895 that we are the sum and substance of the capabilities of the cosmos as something so preposterous as to be exquisitely comic. The idea that man is the best there is just absurd, isn't it? But what does the Bible present to us as the reality of God's involvement in creation? Man is the crowning achievement of creation. That when man was made, that's when God looked at what he had made and said, it is very good, that man is made in the image of God. That in fact, man is the best of all that God has created. And this is not a preposterous proposition, but rather it speaks of the purpose of God and the nature of man. And in moving away from the dogma of creation, you necessarily move away from any notion of the uniqueness or specialness of man. Man is a biological machine. Man has no special place in the cosmos, and you can do whatever you will with man in terms of experimentation or medical processes or whatever else. Man merely typifies in an imperfect way what's going on elsewhere, according to this perspective, and what to a mathematical certainty is in some corners of the cosmos indefinitely excelled. So surely out there somewhere, there are better things than man, better creatures than man. This is a religious perspective. This is a faith perspective, and it's a widely held faith perspective. According to Carl Sagan, Lowell's enthusiasm turned on all the 8-year-olds who came after him and who eventually turned into the present generation of astronomers. So Carl Sagan's perspective, which is almost true, actually his perspective has probably changed because he's deceased now, but his perspective, as far as this is concerned, was probably true that the vast majority of astronomers were looking for something out there that they couldn't find here. They are looking for metaphysical answers and not merely physical answers. They're looking for a satisfactory philosophy of life and not merely an understanding of the physical universe that God had created. Following, again reading from this article, following the Copernican principle, most scientists have supposed that our solar system is typical, and that the origin and evolution of life must be quite likely. Remember, however, as indicated in the articles, including the JPL article about the comet encounter, we don't actually have an explanation for the formation of planets, not a viable, satisfactory explanation. We just don't really have one. But the assumption has been that what happened here probably happened lots and lots of places. There must be lots of stars like this one and lots of systems like the planetary system that we are within on planet Earth. The supposition that our solar system is typical and that the origin and evolution of life must be quite likely given the vast size and great age of the universe. And you've got to have the proposition of vast size, 20 billion light years or so, and the proposition of great age, 15 to 20 billion years of existence, in order to make any sense out of the idea of mechanistic evolution at all, rather than special creation. Accordingly, most have assumed that the universe is probably teeming not just with life, but complex, intelligent life. And that assumption has really carried over into the minds of a lot of people. And it exists kind of side by side, kind of syncretistically, with the idea that God created the cosmos, kind of side by side with the biblical picture of redemption. But it makes no sense side by side with the biblical doctrine of creation, with the biblical doctrine of redemption, that Jesus came to redeem who or what? That the universe, that the cosmos, that the creation was subjected to futility because of who or what? The impact that humankind has on the created universe, the coming day of judgment that involves the whole universe, all the stars and so forth. These things make no sense in this kind of context of the universe teeming with complex, intelligent life. It only makes sense in the context of a created world in which God placed those people who are made in His image. But the scientific evidence has stubbornly pointed in the opposite direction. We're now learning how much must go right to get a habitable planet. And by the way, in terms of arguing for the existence of God, this is what's called the anthropic principle, that there seems to be something uniquely special about our planet and our place in the universe and the very nature of the galaxy that we're a part of, and so on and so on and so on, right on up the ladder. There's something very unique about all of these things, putting us in exactly the right place for life to exist. And the coincidences are just too much to believe in coincidence. The list gets longer all the time. Complex life in particular probably needs many of the things that we earthlings enjoy. A rocky terrestrial planet similar in size and composition to the Earth with plate tectonics to recycle nutrients and the right kind of atmosphere, a large well-placed moon to contribute to tides and stabilize the tilt of the planet's axis. That planet needs to be just the right distance from the right kind of a single star in a nearly circular orbit to maintain liquid water on its surface. All those things have to be just right. The right distance from the right kind of a star, a moon, and the right size and the right distance away from the planet. Surface water, like the oceans, to recycle the nutrients that flow off the land and then are brought back around. All of these cycles through the, including the movement of the plates, the tectonic plates, all of these things have to be just right for life to exist and be sustained. And it is a very unique kind of formula. Life also needs a home within a stable planetary system that includes some outlying giant planets. You remember Shoemaker-Levy crashed into Jupiter. It didn't crash into Earth. And typically, that's what happens to comets that vary from their course. They crash into Jupiter, not into Earth. Jupiter acts as a kind of a shield, protecting Earth from interplanetary impacts, and it does that job very well. Outlying giant planets to protect the inner system from too many deadly comet impacts. That planetary system must be nestled in a safe neighborhood in the right kind of galaxy, and the Milky Way is the right kind of galaxy. We're in the right place in that Milky Way. There's all kinds of problems with radiation if you're not in exactly the right place and exactly the right kind of a galaxy. With enough heavy elements to build terrestrial planets. And that planet will need to form during the narrow habitable window of cosmic history. And that's if you believe in the notion, you know, of vast periods of cosmic time, not just any time is going to be suitable for that. It has to be when all of the things are just right as far as this radiation and the availability of light and the star being at the right stage of its existence and so forth. This is to say nothing of having a universe with a fine-tuned set of physical laws to make stars, planets, and people possible in the first place, but that's another long and complicated story. We have just the right kinds of natural laws to sustain life on planet Earth and the planets and the whole system as we know it. Since the mid-1990s, astronomers have been able to detect planets around other sun-like stars, and this author says that, but I was not actually aware of planets around other sun-like stars. I was aware of planets having been found around other stars that are quite different than our sun and around binary suns, but I hadn't heard of other sun-like stars. And they've taught us an important, if unadvertised, lesson. Planetary systems are not all alike. In fact, mounting evidence suggests that the conditions needed for complex life are exceedingly rare. The probability of them all occurring at the same place and time is minuscule. But we know it happened in one place at one time, despite all of the contrary odds. So argued Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee. Donald Brownlee, that's the same guy that was quoted in the comet articles, okay? The same astronomer who's in charge of the Stardust Project, the same astronomer who commented on the Mars Project. This is a JPL astronomer who is also a professor and is very much involved in all of these kinds of ruminations about life out there. So argued Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee. That is, they argued for a very unique set of criteria for a habitable planet in a best-selling book, Rare Earth, Why Complex Life is Uncommon in the Universe. Ward and Brownlee obviously challenge the letter of the Copernican principle, but they don't challenge its spirits. Intuitively, you might think that such a precise configuration of life-friendly factors suggests that Earth is part of some cosmic design. Ward and Brownlee, however, argue that although the conditions that allow for complex life are highly improbable, perhaps even unique, these conditions are still nothing more than an unintended fluke. And that's part of what really kind of gets me, is people who can look at the utter uniqueness of planet Earth and everything about it, and the utter uniqueness of humankind and life, and look at all of that and say, you know, we have no explanation for this. We have no viable explanation for life of any kind coming into being at all. We're desperately searching for those explanations. But in the meantime, we certainly do not believe that there's anything at work here other than accident. And I find that just really unfathomable from an intellectual standpoint. We have no explanation whatsoever, but we don't like that explanation of intelligent design. And so we're going to continue with no explanation whatsoever and presume that we have an accident in play. The universe, after all, is a big place with some 10 to the 22nd. That's a 1 with 22 zeros after it. With some 10 to the 22nd stars in the part we can see. With so many opportunities, maybe at least one habitable planet will turn up just by chance. Well, actually, in fact, one habitable planet has turned up, right? And we live on it. And it didn't turn up by chance. It turned up by design. It turned up by purpose. The answers to all of the questions, and the questions are more spiritual and metaphysical than they are scientific, the answer to all of the questions are found in the account of the scriptures in the book of Genesis. Here's an article that was in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in February. They were having a little stir in Atlanta over the teaching of evolution in the public schools, or actually over the teaching of alternative ideas. Did you know there are alternative ideas to mechanistic evolution? Well, you wouldn't know that if you looked at the biology textbooks. You wouldn't know that if you visited the high schools of almost any school system in the country and looked at what's being taught. But there are alternative ideas to mechanistic evolution. Governor Sonny Perdue of Georgia says he wants a balanced classroom approach to teaching evolution with an emphasis on its standing as academic theory. State School Superintendent Kathy Cox says her proposed biology curriculum will allow teachers to present other scientific theories about evolution and specifically mentions intelligent design. And there has been a lot of writing by scientists about intelligent design over the last several years, the last 10 years or so. There's been a real burgeoning of materials in physics and biology and chemistry about the idea of intelligent design. Not creationism per se, not saying the Genesis account is true, but saying that our explanations, apart from an intelligent designer, just don't seem to hold up when all is said and done. Across Georgia, scientists cringed at the statements. I thought that was a funny kind of a picture. Somebody says, well, we need to consider the alternatives, and scientists cringed at the statements. Why would they cringe at the statements? What's the problem with considering alternative ideas, in particular, including the idea of the possibility of intelligent design, that maybe these things didn't come about by accident? That causes scientists to cringe. Sarah Paulus, an associate professor of biology at Georgia State University, said Sunday that the public comments reveal an ignorance of science. Okay? An ignorance of science. If we move fast enough, we'll look at a few areas of ignorance in science. An ignorance of science and mimic the arguments used by people who rebut evolution. Well, duh. Yeah, that's right. Evolution can be and should be rebutted. The premises are wrong. The assumptions are wrong. The data doesn't support the premises. The data doesn't support the conclusions. The data doesn't support the theory. It needs to be rebutted. Why is that repugnant? You know, this is where science is supposed to be about discussion. It's supposed to be about comparing ideas and arriving at conclusions. So what's the problem with rebutting a scientific idea? Why is that a problem? It's supposed to be an area of reasoning, of discussing, of arriving at conclusions. But the statements of the governor and the education superintendent sound like the arguments used by people who rebut evolution. Her views were shared by other biologists. Don't bother me with those other ideas. He wants to insert religion into the science curriculum. Actually, nothing he said was about religion, except for displacing an existing religion. Okay? Do we understand that evolution is a religious perspective? It's a mechanistic religion, but it is a religious perspective. That's where he touched on religion, is in saying we should not have this one unique worldview being taught in the schools when there are alternatives that need to be seriously considered. And in fact, there are problems with that worldview, and very serious problems indeed. He wants to insert religion into the science curriculum, Paulus said of Purdue's call for balanced instruction. If there were other scientific theories about the diversity of life, scientists would be inserting them in class. That's our job. Now, see, if you were like me, you'd be laughing just a little bit at that. That's our job. If there were other ideas. There aren't any other ideas. Intelligent design isn't another idea. That's our job. Well, this is the statement of someone who sees themselves not in an educational position, but in a clergy position, a position of priesthood. We hold the truth, and we dispense it as those who are qualified to do so. And no one else is qualified to challenge that truth. That's our job. Well, there are plenty of people in the science community, not in certain kinds of positions, but in the science community, who do challenge the conclusions of Darwinian evolution and neo-Darwinian evolution. Plenty of people who do challenge the tenets of these other mechanistic kinds of ideas. but they are politically silenced. And we're not going to dwell a lot on that, but politics have a lot to do in this arena, as well as others, with the reality of what is being taught and what is excluded from teaching. Hebrews 11 and 3, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. Am I going to be able to prove that God created the world in 6 days? No. Not going to be able to prove that. But I'm going to be able to believe that in a reasonable way. It's consistent with reason to believe that. God's presentation of information, the faith that we have in what God has said, is consistent with reason. Do we have the ability to go back in time and take a video and show, hey, 6 days, God did that? No. Does someone else have the ability to go back 4.5 billion years in time and show the formation of planet Earth? Of course not. Those kinds of things cannot be subjected to empirical scientific testing. But we arrive at conclusions on the basis of available information, or else on the basis of pre-existing prejudices, one or the other. And all too often, the pre-existing prejudices are what come into play. It is reasonable and it is consistent with all evidence to believe that design had a designer, that life came from life, that order is a product of intelligent purpose. And in fact, as suggested in those articles regarding the comet and Mars, we have no other satisfactory explanation of the origin of life or the way planets form or a lot of the other very basic questions that stand behind the mechanistic perception of the universe that is commonly taught. It is, though, reasonable and consistent with all evidence to believe the design had a designer, to believe that intelligence brought about intelligence, to believe that life came from life, that personality came from personality, that in fact there is a creator God. 2 Peter 3 and 6, Peter reminded us, by these waters, that is to say the waters that God separated from the dry land and separated with the firmament in the first chapter of Genesis, by these waters also the world of that time, the world of Noah, was deluged and destroyed. And we talked a little bit about the catastrophic nature of that event yesterday, that it must have changed the world in some very radical ways, as the world was inundated for a year by the waters of the flood and subject to the movement of the tides as the moon continued to do its job, and the layering of sediments and the burying of vast forests that existed in the primeval world, and the sweeping away of civilization, and followed up with the movement of the tectonic plates, almost certainly with the rising up of land masses and the lowering down of land masses. It's very possible, and it is supported at least by some interpretations of scientific evidence, that the world God initially created had one vast continent, but the world after the flood was not one vast continent. That there were tremendous changes in the makeup, in the topography of the world on which we live in that event. 2 Peter 3:10, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief, the heavens will disappear with a roar, the elements will be destroyed by fire, and the earth and everything in it will be laid bare. There's another catastrophic change coming, isn't there? And if you don't believe in the first one, you're probably not going to really believe in the second one either. But these things are bound together in the scriptures. They're part and parcel of the whole picture of what God has done. We have a series of world-shaking past events presented to us in the Bible. There's the creation account in Genesis 1 and 2, when God made it all. We have the account of how sin came into the world in the third chapter of Genesis. And do we understand that that changed the world and, in fact, apparently affected the entire universe when man sinned? By man, death came. The world, the universe, or rather the creation, as Paul puts it in the 8th chapter of Romans, down in verse 35 in that vicinity, he's talking about the created realm being subjected to futility in hope. But the whole creation was subjected to futility. When I read that, I understand that to mean not only the ground is cursed for your sake, as God said to Adam, but that affected everything about the physical universe, because God did not intend for man to live forever in that state, and so we have the removal of man from the garden, and we have changes taking place in biology, changes taking place in the ecosystem that man was a part of, including, I think, this entire vast universe that exists around us. We have the account of the flood, which at the very least had a tremendous impact on planet Earth and may have involved some changes in the solar system itself, for all we know. And there are some reasons to suspect that it might have brought about some changes in that series of events in the solar system itself. We have the Tower of Babel, which at least was earth-shaking in terms of humankind. All the earth was of one language, and people were working together to a common end, which was not in harmony with the purpose that God had indicated, the command that God had given to Noah and his sons to replenish the earth. And they said, let's stay together and build this great project as a unifying feature for our culture and our civilization. And God said, I don't want them to, as I interpret it, God said, I don't want them to go down the road they went down before, when every inclination of man's heart was only evil continually. God said, if we let them do this, then they're going to be able to do anything they want to do. And he didn't want that to happen. And so God caused the scattering of mankind at that time. He did so by the confusion of language. Language is one of those things, by the way, that argues very strongly for special creation. There simply is no realistic explanation for the origin of language except special creation. Back in the 30s, the linguist, anthropologist Noam Chomsky observed that language seemed to be innate in human beings. And despite all efforts in the decades since then to figure out language from animals and to talk about animals being able to communicate and so forth, there still is no explanation for language other than it being an innate part of the human psyche, that it's built into us. This ability, this desire, this need to communicate is built into us by a communicating creator. In Genesis 10:25 and 11:16, we have mention of a character named Peleg. And Peleg, it's mentioned in just a kind of a passing way. We don't have any idea. We can speculate, but we don't have any real idea of what happened there. It may be in direct connection with the Tower of Babel that this event took place. But it says of Peleg in Genesis 25, he was named Peleg, which means divided. It means like water coming between two things. That he was named Peleg because in his days the earth was divided. Now, in what way was it divided? What kind of catastrophic, cataclysmic event took place to divide the earth at that time? We're not given an explanation of it. Was this not continental drift, but continental shoving? Was there some tremendous movement of the continents at that time to separate groups of humans from one another? We can speculate, but we don't know, because it's passed over in such a brief way there in Genesis. But some kind of tremendous event happened, and we can tell it's a tremendous event because if we look at the lifespans that are recorded there in the 11th chapter of Genesis, we have a sudden drop, and the lifespans are cut in half right there at that point in time. We go from men living 400 and some years to men living 200 and some years, just like that. In one generation, we have that kind of a picture presented there in Genesis 11 and 16. So whatever it was a tremendous earth-shaking kind of event that affected a lot of things and was not a superficial kind of happening at all. The Exodus, I'm suggesting to you, was also a world-shaking event. And I'm going to turn and read Psalm 114 because I think that this perspective is one that we don't always hold. But I have become persuaded that the Exodus was an event of much grander proportions than we sometimes think that it may have been. And that's partly influenced by reading a book by a man named David Rawl about the chronologies that we have on ancient history and Egyptian chronology and so forth. And then it was further influenced by reading some rather strange things by a man named Belikovsky. I won't necessarily recommend his books, but there are some intriguing things in his books to think about at any rate. And then reading what the psalmist says here about Psalm 114, it seems to me that sometimes we may not see the Exodus and the events surrounding it in quite a large enough perspective, because I don't think the psalmist is merely using hyperbole here. When Israel came out of Egypt, the house of Jacob, from a people of foreign tongue, Judah became God's sanctuary, Israel his dominion. The sea looked and fled, the Jordan turned back, the mountains skipped like rams, the hills like lambs. Why was it, O sea, that you fled, O Jordan, that you turned back, you mountains that you skipped like rams, you hills like lambs? Tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the God of Jacob, who turned the rock into a pool, the hard rock into springs of water. We have references there to several things that happened during the Exodus event, right? We have reference to crossing the Red Sea at the beginning and reference to crossing the Jordan River at the end, and both times they crossed on dry ground. We have reference to the water coming out of the rock, which happened on two occasions, one at the beginning and one almost at the end of that particular journey. We have also a reference here, twice over, to the idea of mountains skipping like rams and hills like lambs. And other than the ground shaking at Mount Sinai, and maybe that's all he means, maybe he only means the ground shaking at Mount Sinai, but this seems like awfully strong language if that's all he's talking about. It seems as though there may have been a lot of earth-shaking things happening right at that time, both to bring Israel out of Egypt and to set the ground for them to move into Canaan, and that there may have been a lot of ground-shaking kinds of things going on at that time in the Exodus. And there are some other non-biblical reasons to think that might be true, but we don't know for sure what all was going on there. Then we have also the accounts in Joshua chapter 10 of the long day, when Joshua asked for the daylight to basically just hold its position, sun stand still and moon hold your place, and God did what Joshua asked, and we have several hours there. And by the way, this is one of those areas where every now and then you'll run across one of those phony evidences for the Bible. Somebody will send around now and then by email, and it used to turn up occasionally in other publications, that scientists at NASA have found the lost day of Joshua, the long day of Joshua, that there's some sort of cosmological clock that they were able to determine. No, that's all nonsense. There's no way to look back in time and see that something like this ever took place. We accept it by faith because the Bible says so, and the Bible's a credible source. And that's the only basis we have to support this, is that the Bible says so. But since I know that everything around that is true, everything else that the Bible says is true, I accept that also on the basis of faith, that what is described there happened. Did that happen without consequences? Did the stopping of the movement of the day happen without consequences? Were there effects throughout the world? Again, in the strange writings of Velikovsky, he thinks there are ancient records that substantiate that idea that while there was light over here, there was darkness over here, and that there are ancient testimonies to that effect. I don't know for sure how legitimate those things are, but we can imagine that there may have been some broad effects, large or small, from God changing the behavior of the cosmos even for a few hours, as he did there. Or again, in the days of Hezekiah, 2 Kings chapter 29 through 11, when the sundial moved backward, was there any other effect there besides the movement of the shadow on the sundial? Well, it's hard to think that there wasn't some kind of effect, but we just don't know for sure what may have happened. Or the account of Jesus' death in Matthew 27:45, when it describes an earthquake that I would take to be relatively local, but it also talks about darkness over the whole land. And I'm not sure whether land there means around Jerusalem or whether, because the same word is used to describe the whole earth, and also is used to describe the ground in a garden when you go out and sow your seed. And so I don't know whether we're talking about an event where the whole world was darkened for a period, or whether locally around Jerusalem and Judea it was darkened for this period of time. I don't know. But I do know that God has the ability to reach into his creation and do what he will. And on a number of occasions, he has reached into his creation and changed things and shaped things to his purpose and his desire. Not only at the very beginning, but repeatedly since then, God has interfered in the natural law process of creation. He has brought about changes, some of them certainly not without long-term effect. Some of them, like the flood and the dividing of the earth in the days of Peleg, that certainly had long-term effect on the topography, the geography, the geology of planet Earth, and some of them the biology of planet Earth as well. The curse, death, and all of the consequences that were associated with human sin back there in the third chapter of Genesis. There have been many, many things that affected the nature of the planet on which we live as God has been continuing to be involved in it. There's a list of doctrines here that I'm not going to have time to go over that are associated with the Genesis account of creation. The Genesis account of creation is supported by evidence at least as well. You see, I can say it that way. No, I'll say it other than that. Better than any other alternative suggestion, idea, theory, proposition as to the origin of the universe. The book of Genesis account is not in conflict with evidence. It certainly is in conflict with interpretation of scientific data. It certainly is in conflict with ideas of the way things have come about. It is not in conflict with any actual data that we have, any actual information that we have about the nature of the past or the nature of the world or the universe that we are a part of, or the nature of man. We have a lot of doctrines in the Bible that are directly tied to the dogma of creation. You cannot have a true Bible if Genesis 1 is a parable. It just doesn't work. You cannot have a true Bible if Genesis 1 doesn't give us an accurate picture of what God has done. From the giving of the law at Mount Sinai, when God said that they should remember the Sabbath and keep it holy because in 6 days he made the universe and everything in it, from that point onward, again and again, God justifies his actions, his moral actions, his authority, the nature of the relationship between man and woman. These kinds of things are justified again and again on the basis of God's original created order, the things that God is pictured as doing in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. Jesus, being presented as the Son of God to us in the Gospel of John, is presented as one who was there at the creation and things being made by him and for him. But if you come down to in the right-hand column, the third item, sin and death in Adam, this is one of the most compelling aspects of biblical doctrine being tied to my way of thinking, at any rate, being tied to the doctrine of creation, is that forgiveness is meaningful because in the first man, Adam, all died, and in the second man, Christ, the new Adam, all are made alive. And that's in Romans chapter 5, verses 12 through 17. In 1 Corinthians 15, 45 through 49, we talk about the first man, Adam, being made of the dust, earthly, and the second Adam coming from heaven, being the spiritual being, which we shall be in his likeness. As we have been in the likeness of the physical created man, so shall we be in the likeness of the glorified man, Jesus Christ. And the lineage of Jesus is run for us all the way back to Adam in the book of Luke. We have repeatedly this idea that the whole scheme of redemption in the Bible is connected to the Creator's original intent and purpose as described in the first two chapters of Genesis. His salvation through Christ, his eternal plan, is all connected to the notion that he made us just as described in the book of Genesis. Now, I have a whole series of slides here that I don't have time, and I knew I wouldn't have time. I thought I might do a couple of them. I know I certainly wouldn't do all of them. Regarding things that are commonly taught that are simply not true. People who were in Iowa last year saw Rick talk about and go over some of these very same things. But when I was looking at my son Nathaniel's biology textbook, he was a sophomore and had high school biology this past year. When I was looking at my son Nathaniel's textbook, I found that every one of these things that are brought up in a book called Icons of Evolution were there in his biology textbook. And these are things that are known to be wrong. Okay, these are not creationist ideas. These are things that are known to be wrong scientifically, such as the Miller-Urey experiment where supposedly the building blocks of life were made in a test tube back in the 1950s. Well, for 30 years, scientists have known that that experiment, number one, didn't produce nearly enough. That is to say, it produced only very simple amino acids. It didn't produce any of the complex amino acids necessary for life. And number two, the atmosphere that was put into that experiment was simply wrong in the first place. It doesn't duplicate what should have been there in their perception of how planet Earth would have existed and been formed. That the experiment is simply bogus. It doesn't work at all. And yet, if you pick up a high school biology textbook printed in 2002, you'll find this experiment as an explanation or as a support for the idea of mechanistic evolution. Why do we still have data in the textbooks that are known to be faulty, that are known to be unacceptable, that are known to not support the idea of evolution? It's not only the Miller-Urey experiment, it's also the drawings of the embryos by Ernst Haeckel. The drawings of the embryos by Haeckel. This guy over 100 years ago drew these embryos with an intention of supporting Darwinian evolution by showing the similarity of embryo development between all kinds of animals. And it is known, it was known at the time that his picture was a fantasy, was a fiction. That what he drew, that what he made, the wood blocks that he made, he in fact used the same wood blocks for more than one species of animal in his presentation. It's been known for 100 years that what he drew was not true. His own contemporaries denounced his work. And yet it's still in biology textbooks. Why is this still in biology textbooks? Even Stephen Gould, an ardent evolutionist, acknowledged in the 1990s that this shouldn't be in textbooks because it simply is not true. It's not an accurate depiction of what we know to be the case. We have pictures of actual embryos now that could be in there. The problem is the pictures of actual embryos don't support this kind of a premise at all. And so these things still show up in biology textbooks now. These things were in my son Nathaniel's textbook, which was printed in 2002, long after it has not only been known but publicly known to be untrue. We could go on and talk about Darwin's Tree of Life, which is known to be a very inaccurate presentation. There's no support for this kind of a tree in the fossil record, and yet the Tree of Life still continues to be printed very much as Darwin originally drew it in biology textbooks today. He drew it based on a premise that he was sure would eventually be supported by the fossil record. It never was supported by the fossil record. And in fact, modern genetics decry the tree that he drew. Modern genetics have shown that his tree was not at all an accurate picture of the relationships between living creatures, and yet this is still in biology textbooks today. We have the idea of homology, of the different features looking the same on different kinds of animals. But one of the problems with that is that you take the forearm of a frog, and it looks more like the forearm of a human than the forearm of a horse looks like the forearm of a human. And according to the premises of evolutionary biology, which should be more similar, which should be more closely related, the horse and the human or the frog and the human? Well, the frog is, in the evolutionary scheme of things, much more distant from the human, And yet the form of a frog forearm is much more like the form of a human forearm, because those have nothing to do with relationship. They have to do with purpose and design. They have to do with function. They don't tell us anything about relationship. And yet this kind of information is still being put into biology textbooks in spite of the fact that it is known to biologists. Biologists know. But what did that biologist say? That's our job. If there were other ideas, wouldn't we present them? That's our job. Well, they're not doing their job. It's time to take a break.